This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Jerry Bock, who wrote the music for such Broadway hits as Fiorello, She Loves Me, and Fiddler on the Roof, died Wednesday of heart failure. He was 81. Today, to pay tribute, we'll listen back to an interview Terry recorded with Jerry Bock and his songwriting partner, lyricist Sheldon Harnick. They spoke in 2004, the year a new revival of Fiddler on the Roof was being produced on Broadway. It starred Alfred Molina as Tevye, the role originated by Zero Mostel. The original production of Fiddler opened on Broadway in September 1964 and ran for 3,242 performances. Here's how Zero opened that show.
A fiddler on the roof. Sounds crazy, no? But in our little village of Anatevka, you might say, every one of us is a fiddler on the roof, trying to scratch out a pleasant, simple tune without breaking his neck. It isn't easy. You may ask, why do we stay up there if it's so dangerous? We stay because Anatevka is our home. And how do we keep our balance? That, I can tell you in one word, tradition. Tradition!
Jerry Bock, when you were writing the music for Fiddler on the Roof, how Jewish did you want the music to sound? How much did you want it to sound like klezmer music, and how much did you want it to sound like Broadway music?
It never entered my mind in either case. I knew the ambience was going to be Russian and that it took place in a shtetl, but I had no compulsion to research either early klezmer or particularly Russian music at the turn of that century, or just before the turn of the century. What happened was that, for some inexplicable reason, the music that I hadn't been able to write with all our shows was something that I had silently deposited in my creative mind. And the opportunity to now express myself with that kind of music just opened up a flood of possibilities for me.
So let's hear Zero Mostel from the original cast recording doing If I Were a Rich Man.
Dear God, you made many, many poor people. I realize, of course, that it's no shame to be poor, but it's no great honor either. So what would have been so terrible if I had a small fortune? If I were a rich man, all day long I'd biddy biddy bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. If I were a biddy biddy rich, idle diddle 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 man, I'd build a big tall house with rooms by the dozen right in the middle of the town. A fine tin roof with a real wooden floors below. There couldn't be one long staircase just going up and one even longer coming down. And one more leading nowhere just for show. I'd fill my yard with chicks and turkeys and geese and ducks for the town to see and hear, squawking just as noisily as they can. And each loud will land like a trumpet on the ear, as if to say here lives a wealthy man. If I were a rich man, all day long I'd biddy biddy bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. If I were a biddy biddy rich,
Yidle-diddle-diddle-diddle-man. I see my wife, my God.
Sheldon Harnick, the yidle-diddle-digga-digga-doo part.
Right.
Did you actually write out the syllables that you wanted Zero Mostel to sing?
Well, it wasn't that I necessarily wrote them for Zero, but what happened was this. When Jerry played me the music he wrote, he did the whole song in that kind of a Hasidic chant. And we decided that it would be great fun to preserve part of the chant and not just to write wall-to-wall lyrics for the song. But my problem was I don't come from a background where I was comfortable chanting in that fashion. And I thought, okay, I'll have to create some kind of syllables which give the effect of that kind of chanting. And I came up with the diddle deedle diddle digga digga deedle diddle dum, which I thought was kind of fun and sounded a little like the chanting. But when we played the song for Zero, he said, I come from a background. I don't want to do the syllables you've written. Is it okay with you if I do it the way I think it should be done? And I said, absolutely. I said, I can't sing it that way. So Zero did it with his stylistically. It sounded quite
authentic.
Authentic, yeah. So when I perform the song, I have to do it with the syllables because that's the only way I can sing it.
By the way, if Sheldon had said no, absolutely not, you must do the lyric, he would have done it. He would have done it his way anyway.
Right?
Was he hard or easy to work with?
He was
both.
In terms of music, he was although he was not a singer, he was extremely musical.
Yes.
So that in that sense, he was very easy. And as a matter of fact, he did me a huge favor. After he started to learn If I Were a Rich Man, I got nervous about it because I thought most of the song is rather droll, and then I went for a serious ending, and I began to worry whether I should change the ending and make the ending droll also. So I suggested that in a conference we had one day. I think Hal Prince was there and Jerome Robbins and Zero. And Zero looked at me and said, Sheldon, he said, don't change the ending. If you want to, this is the man. He said, it's the jokes in the song are terrific, but this is the man that you've described, the man who wants a seat by the Eastern Wall, who wants to be able to pray. This is the real Tevye. So he said, we kept the ending, and I'm glad we did.
I'm glad, too.
Now, I want to go to another song, and that is Do I Love You? And
Do you love me?
Do you love me?
No. Do you
We're
love me?
We're very flattered.
It's Do you love me? Do I love you? Yes. So,
will we please answer that question?
And this is a song, all of Tevye's daughters, like, they want to fall in love. They don't want their father, Tevye, to decide who they're going to marry. They don't want the matchmaker to decide it. At this point, they want to fall in love, and at least one of them already has. And she wants to marry the man she loves. And this is leading Tevye to wonder, well, what about his relationship? Does his wife love him? What is love? And he sings the song, and it's a lovely song. Sheldon Harnick, can you talk about the lyric?
Yes. During rehearsal, when we were in New York, I began to feel that there was a song that would develop out of Tevye's saying, Do you love me? I always thought when Golda would say, Do I what? Because that was... love was not something that people married for generally in those days. They married for security. They married for economic reasons, companionship, but not love. So when I pictured her saying, Do I what? I thought, that's very funny. But I couldn't figure out where the song went from there. And when we got to Detroit, our pre-Broadway tour, I used to take long walks every day and try and figure out what they would say. And the lyric came very slowly and in a kind of unconventional form. When I finally finished it, after about a week, I gave it to Jerry, very uncertain about what I had. And I said, I know that it looks more like a scene than a song, so do what you can with it, and if I have to rewrite the lyric, I will. And I was absolutely delighted when Jerry set the lyric exactly as I gave it to him.
I just wanted to add very quickly, Terry, that the difference between Zero's Do You Love Me and Alfred's is astonishing. Zero did get laughs. He approached it as almost a kind of incredulous question to ask and took advantage of every humorous possibility. Alfred does it most sincerely in terms of a true and real question. He wants to know the answer, and as a result, it's a very moving moment rather than a humorous one in this current production.
Yeah, and while we're on that subject, I just have to put in a word that our Golda, Randy Graff, is in her own way, she's as wonderful as Fred Molina is.
Yes.
Well, let's hear Alfred Molina and Randy Graff from the new cast recording of Fiddler on the Roof. This is Do You Love Me?
Golda. Do you love me?
Do I what?
Do you love me?
Do I love you? With our daughters getting married and this trouble in the town, you're upset, you're worn out. Go inside, go lie down. Maybe it's indigestion.
Golda, I'm asking you a question. Do you love me?
You're a fool.
I know. But do you love me?
Do I love you?
Well?
For 25 years I've washed your clothes, cooked your meals, cleaned your house, given you children, milked the cow. After 25 years, why talk about love right now?
Golda. The first time I met you was on our wedding day. I was scared.
I was shy.
I was nervous.
So was I.
But my father and my mother said we'd learn to love each other. Now I'm asking, Golda, do you love me?
I'm your wife.
But do you love me?
Do I love him?
Well,
for 25 years I've lived with him, fought with him, starved with him. 25 years my bed is his. If that's not love, what is?
Then you love me. And I suppose I love you, too. It doesn't change a thing. But even so, after 25 years, it's nice to
Alfred Molina and Randy Graff from the 2004 revival of Fiddler on the Roof. Composer Jerry Bock and lyricist Sheldon Harnick spoke to Terry Gross in 2004. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with composer Jerry Bock and lyricist Sheldon Harnick, who collaborated on the musicals Fiorello, She Loves Me, and Fiddler on the Roof. Jerry Bock died of heart failure this week at the age of 81. Here's To Life from the original cast recording of Fiddler on the Roof.
Here's to our prosperity, our good health and happiness, and most important, to life, l'chaim. L'chaim, l'chaim, to life. Here's to the father I try to be.
Here's to my bride-to-be.
Drink l'chaim, to life, l'chaim. L'chaim, l'chaim, to life.
Life has a way of confusing us,
blessing and bruising us.
Drink L'chaim to life. God would like us to be joyful, even when our hearts lie panting on the floor.
How much more can we be joyful when there's really something to be joyful for?
To life, L'chaim. To title my daughter,
my wife. It gives you something to think about,
something to drink about. Drink L'chaim to life.
Yes, drinks for everybody.
This is the only song that actually has a Yiddish word in it, L'chaim, which is a toast to life. So Sheldon Harnack, when you were writing the lyrics, it seems to me you intentionally avoided using anything Yiddish with the exception of this song.
Well, there is one other song. The Dream uses the word Mazel Tov.
Oh, but, that's true. A blessing on your head, Mazel yeah. Tov, Mazel Tov.
Well, there was a reason for that. Not too long before we went into rehearsal, I went to see a comedian named Lenny Bruce. I'd heard that Lenny Bruce was controversial because he used a lot of profanity and obscenities in his act. And I was curious. So I went to see him. And it turned out that the obscenities and the profanities were all done as characters that he portrayed, and so that they sounded like things those particular characters would actually say. And I wasn't disturbed by the profanity or the obscenity at all. What did disturb me was that when he wasn't doing the characters and he was just talking, he would throw in Yiddish words. And they would elicit laughter from a few people here and there, but many of the other people in the club turned to each other and said, "What did he say? What did he say?" So I thought, it'll be probably useful to use a couple of Yiddish words in our show, in the dialogue and in the lyrics, just a couple for flavoring. But if anyone laughs when they're used, then they come out. And also, when they're used, they have to be used in a way that the audience will know what they mean. So, of course, into life, there's an explanation that goes along with the Yiddish word. Right. to life, L'chaim, L'chaim. Nobody can miss that. And the word Mazel Tov is usually used in a setting where it's pretty clear that it means congratulations.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Good fortune.
Unhappily, after the show is running, the original show is running, our dear star Zero would occasionally go into a matinee and use more Yiddish than we ever could have dreamed of in certain performances to sort of make him a confidant of what he thought that kind of audience was. We all thought that was naughty, to put it mildly.
Well, we're almost out of time here. I have to ask you the sunrise, sunset question. It's a song that became a terrible cliche for quite a while because everybody was doing it at those emotional moments when your child is finally grown up. Did you
My
think,
favorite cliche.
Yes, exactly. And probably the one of the most lucrative cliches, too. Did you ever think when you were writing it the kind of life the song was going to have?
No. Jerry had written the music first. He sent it to me on a tape, and I thought, gee, that's a lovely song. I think that would be perfect to sing at the wedding. And as I've said in an interview previously, the lyric kind of crystallized on the melodic curve of the song. When we finished it, Jerry was living in New Rochelle at the time. We called his wife down to the studio, and we played it for Patty. And when we looked at her at the end of the song, she was crying.
Tears in her eyes, yes.
And then I played it for my sister shortly after that, and she was crying. And we thought, ooh, this song probably this has more effectiveness than we imagined.
Mind you, we didn't know whether they were tears of joy or that's awful.
Jerry Bock, what did you listen to when you were writing the show? Did you listen to much music?
Not really. Somehow, as I said, I had unknowingly, unwittingly stored a lot of the sound of it without having been able to express myself with it. I love Russian music. I love Romanian music. Minor is my major key. so with all that in mind, it just I think Sheldon and I probably wrote maybe 3-1 for every song that was used. We wrote at least 3. And if we were asked to write 10 or 15 more, we probably could have, because It was the kind of show that allowed us to express ourselves as we had never expressed ourselves before.
I want to thank you so much, not only for talking with us, but thank you for all the great songs you've given us. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Composer Jerry Bock and lyricist Sheldon Harnick speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. As a writing team, their Broadway musical credits include Fiorello, She Loves Me, and one of the most popular musicals in history, Fiddler on the Roof. Jerry Bock died this week of heart failure at age 81. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross.
Enter Hamlet.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the stings and arrows. Sorry. The slings and arrows. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and end. The slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them?
Ouch. That's a Hollywood heartthrob rehearsing Hamlet in a scene from the TV series called Slings and Arrows. It's set backstage and on stage at a dysfunctional Canadian theater company that produces an annual Shakespeare festival. Slings and Arrows originated in Canada and has been shown on the Sundance Channel. A complete series DVD box set has just come out on Blu-ray. Our next guest, Mark McKinney, co-created and co-wrote the series and plays the role of the company's chief administrator, Richard Smith Jones. Richard has to deal with two temperamental directors. One is troubled but brilliant. The other is a pretentious egomaniac. Mark McKinney was a cast member of the Canadian sketch comedy series The Kids in the Hall and went from there to Saturday Night Live. Here's another scene from Slings and Arrows. Richard and one of the company's funders have just come out of seeing a production of the ABBA musical Mamma Mia. The funder is played by Jennifer Irwin.
Yes! Fantastic! Yes! That was fantastic! Oh, my God, man! The dancing and the singing! I understood every word!
I know! I swear to God, it gets better every time!
Thank you. Just goes to show you gotta keep things in perspective, you know? You know, I saw Chorus Line when I was 16 on Broadway. I was blown away. You know, I cried.
I love that show.
It's what made me want to go into theater. I used to listen to all those albums, you know, Damn Yankees, Kiss Me, Kate. My parents thought I was gay. How the hell did I went up and use bourbon? How did that happen?
Okay, do not torture yourself. Come on, let's go for a drink.
You know what they are? They're pure entertainment.
That's right.
I'm so sick of hearing it's a dense play. Oh, it's a difficult play. I've never seen anyone come dancing and singing out of the swan like we just did.
I know, and why do you think that is?
Well, because Shakespeare. Shakespeare's like
400 years old.
And I don't even think he was that good. There, I said it. I mean, you know, at entertaining people. I mean, I'm not saying that, like, ABBA were better writers.
No, I know what you mean.
I don't like Shakespeare.
Nobody does, Richard. That's the thing. You put on plays that nobody wants to see. God, what a waste.
You're right.
That's Mark McKinney in a scene from the first season of Slings and Arrows. Mark McKinney, welcome to Fresh Air. One of the things I love about Slings and Arrows is it gets to some of the things that are most wonderful about good theater and most cringe-inducing about bad theater. So I thought we'd start with some of the cringe-inducing stuff. Don McKellar, who's a really good Canadian actor, and I think director, too. Does he direct?
Director and writer, yeah.
Yeah, so he plays a very pretentious director who's originally brought in to direct, to take over a production of Hamlet. And this is a director so pretentious and so wanting to put his like own touch on everything, his own creative touch, that he did a version of The Tempest set in Nazi Germany. So let's hear a scene from episode 3 of the first season of Slings and Arrows. And this is how this very pretentious director introduces himself to the cast of Hamlet when he takes over the production.
Hello, everyone. I am Darren Nichols. Deal with that. All right. Re-Hamlet. Hamlet. This play is dead. It has been dead for over 300 years. It has been strip-mined for quotations and propped up like Lenin in his ice cave. I don't worship dead texts, but that doesn't mean I don't find interest in them. Now, as to my vision, I'm taking the word rotten, as in something's rotten in the state of Denmark, very seriously. I want a rank and foul-looking, foul-acted, and if possible, foul-smelling Hamlet. A decomposed vessel somewhere between the swamp and the sewer. Anyway, that's the general idea. Questions? Okay, let's read this corpse.
That's so great. That's Don McKellar in a scene from Slings and Arrows playing a very pretentious director. And my guest Mark McKinney is one of the writers of the series and one of the stars. This character must have been so much fun to write. So what are some of the awful traits you gave this director?
Well, he's completely self-obsessed, and he's, you know, he's the second son, and Jeffrey, played by Paul Gross, is clearly the gifted one. And I think he goes around with just this hanging resentment, this bitterness that he knows he can't, you know, dare to get it right. So he just derides and mocks, and that's where his creativity comes from, is putting down the very thing that he should be embracing.
In the final season of Slings and Arrows, there's a production of Lear that the Shakespeare Festival is doing. And the actor playing Lear is a leading Shakespearean actor who is secretly dying of cancer. And when this production happens at the end, it's after they've totally run out of money. They're only going to do it once. And so this performance that they actually do give is incredibly moving. And the actor who plays the actor playing Lear is really great. Tell us a little bit about that actor and the circumstances surrounding this performance.
Well, William Hutt, who played the character Charles Kingman, who's the dying actor, who's the heroin addict, and who plays the Lear in the third series, had actually given a legendary Lear at the Stratford Festival a couple of years before the series. And for some reason, this had never been taped. And so this is the archive of at least pieces of that great performance. And we're lucky to get it, as he actually died last year.
So the actor who played the actor playing Lear died not long after making the show.
No, he died, in the fall.
I'd like to play just a clip from that performance of Lear, the play within the series.
Oh, you are made of stone, and I your tongues and eyes. I'd use them so that heaven's vault should crack. She's gone forever. I know when one is dead. And when one lives, she's dead as earth. Lend me a looking glass, that if her breath or mist will stain the stone wherein she lives.
LX57 go?
And stand by for curtain call, everyone.
That's a scene from Slings and Arrows, and my guest, Mark McKinney, is one of the co-writers of the series and one of the stars. And he didn't write King Lear, however.
Well, bits of it.
Bits of it, yeah. In a series about really, you know, creative directors and actors, why did you cast yourself as the suit, the money guy, who kind of wants to be creative but maybe really isn't?
Well, I don't know. Maybe because I sort of look at actors as something other than what I am. Do you know what I mean? I think I was kind of brought up to expect people to be reasonable. And I think artistic behavior, particularly tantrums, used to scare me when I first got into the business. And so I always had this part of myself that was wrestling with the reasonable versus the impulsive. And I see that conflict in Richard, like not sure what lane he should pick here.
So I take it you're not the kind of actor who brings the theater into real life. You know, like some people are so theatrical offstage as well as on, and they always seem to be in some kind of performance.
No, I think on the street you'd mistake me for a horticulturist.
Now, one of the movies you were in was Spice World, the Spice Girls movie.
Do you want me to sign your DVD?
Yeah, oh yeah.
You got everyone with me.
What was your part in it? I didn't see the movie. What was your part in it?
What?
What?
Well, why are we doing this interview? My part was George Went and I played sort of a producer-writer team, and he was my producer, and I was his writer. And so we're trying to concoct the movie within the movie for the Spice Girls.
But you've written so many things that you've been in. You didn't participate in the writing in this, did you?
Of that, no.
Did you wish you had? I mean, do you sometimes end up performing in something where you feel like you could make it much better if you were rewriting it?
Not often. No, I've been really lucky. Unless I'm completely myopic, I haven't been in a lot of junk, and I'm lucky that way.
You're a writer and you're an actor. Do both of those jobs draw on different parts of who you are?
Yeah, completely. In fact, they affect your lifestyle. And on Kids in the Hall, it was very dramatic because we would go through cycles, 3, 4, 5 weeks of writing, then sort of a slow prep towards performing. And when I was writing, I would be up at 8 o'clock. My place was neat. My dishes were done. I wasn't living to excess. And then as we sort of folded and became actors, you know, the laundry would pile up and the nights would get later and the behavior more irresponsible until the whole thing would sort of roll through again. And I think it does trade off completely different sides of your personality.
Why would the actor part be more like sloppy or irresponsible?
Well, because I think you're tapping into sort of an impulsivity, and I think that there's more of a certain type of adrenaline released when you're performing that, you know, makes you stick around for an extra beer or, you know, watch 3 hours of CNN before you go to bed.
Well, Mark McKinney, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Cheer up, Hamlet. Chin up, Hamlet. Buck up, you melancholy Dan. So your uncle is a cad who murdered Dad and married Mum. That's really no excuse to be as glum as you've become. So wise up, Hamlet. Rise up, Hamlet. Perk up and sing a new refrain. Your incessant monologizing fills the castle with ennui. Your antic disposition is embarrassing to see. And by the way, your sulky brat, the answer is to be. You're driving poor Ophelia insane. So shut up, you rogue and peasant. Grow up, it's most unpleasant. Cheer up, your melancholy Dane.
That's from the Canadian TV series Slings and Arrows. Mark McKinney, co-creator and co-star of the show, spoke to Terry Gross in 2008. Slings and Arrows was just released as a complete series DVD box set on Blu-ray. In 1972, when the Rolling Stones toured the United States for the first time since their disastrous free concert at Altamont, they decided to film 4 performances in Fort Worth and Houston, Texas, for a theatrical release. The band was promoting its ambitious double album, Exile on Main Street. The finished film, Ladies and Gentlemen, The Rolling Stones, was rarely shown and has never been officially released for home viewing. Until now. Music critic Milo Miles has a review.
Of the films that feature the Rolling Stones in concert, there are two that matter. One is Gimme Shelter, but that Altamont documentary isn't really about the Stones, is it? The other one was more talked about than seen over the years, but you can finally enjoy Ladies and Gentlemen, the Rolling Stones in the comfort of your own flat-screen TV, rather than in the hit-and-miss quadraphonic setup in which it was originally released in a few theaters. But wait, what about Martin Scorsese's 2008 Stones movie, Shine a Light, certainly the most cinematically rich documentary of the band ever? I think the difference between Ladies and Gentlemen and Shine a Light is captured in a moment before the music even starts. In Shine a Light, Bill and Hillary Clinton greet the band before the show, and in fact, the two performances were a benefit for the ex-president's foundation and a celebration of his 60th birthday. It's hard to get across what a scandal it would have been in 1972 if any high government official, let alone an ex-president, had such an intimate public connection with a Rolling Stones concert. Yes, presidents are more comfortable with rock and roll these days, but the Stones are fundamentally transformed. They're not dangerous anymore. And not all the fancy camera angles and inspired lighting and steely professionalism in Scorsese's movie can make up for that. When Mick Jagger performs Jumpin' Jack Flash in Ladies and Gentlemen, he's not merely invoking a world-famous rock and roll classic, he's incarnating it. Ladies and Gentlemen, the Rolling Stones reflects an early days concept of what a rock show should be. An almost punk-like spareness to the stage set. 15 songs and a punchy 82 minutes and a furious, almost deranged set of final numbers. It's also clear by now that this was the most varied and cohesive set of players for the group. Sidemen were Bobby Keys on saxophone, Jim Price on horns, and Nicky Hopkins on piano. But the crucial regular band member was guitarist Mick Taylor, looking like a pre-Raphaelite cherub dropped into a nest of gargoyles. Unlike his ultimate replacement, Ron Wood, Taylor did not sound or solo like Keith Richards. He was gritty enough, but a subtle, lyrical blues man. This is Taylor's climactic solo on Robert Johnson's Love in Vain. For the Rolling Stones, I think the most fundamental change of all since 1972 is that bluesmen aren't what they used to be. Once the blues was the voice of outsiders who wouldn't sugarcoat love or tell you lies about work and success. Because the Stones were bold when they turned the language of blues-based rock to contemporary youth and events, they seemed like fearless, ravaged realists. But if the Stones never became aristocrats, they did become plutocrats and supreme showbiz insiders. The blues faded as a living music language, and though they tried and tried and searched everywhere, the Stones never found as durable a style as the blues to tell hard truths or at least deliver indelible threats like Midnight Rambler. But in Ladies and Gentlemen, the Rolling Stones, Mick, Keith, and the boys were fluent in the blues like nobody else. For established pop music icons, the Stones have been uncommonly reluctant to look back. By all accounts, the big impediment is Jagger, who feels the vintage material doesn't meet his standards. This release of Ladies and Gentlemen includes a new interview with Jagger, in which he grants his seal of approval, saying the band sounds on and together. The cagey old codger is underselling a masterpiece.
Milo Miles reviewed the concert film Ladies and Gentlemen, The Rolling Stones, now available on DVD. Two big studio movies will vie for an audience this weekend. The comedy Due Date is the latest from Todd Phillips, who had a smash hit with The Hangover. Due Date stars Robert Downey Jr. and Zach Galifianakis as a mismatched pair who end up taking a road trip together. And the movie 127 Hours is Danny Boyle's first feature film since Slumdog Millionaire and stars James Franco as a hiker pinned by a boulder in a canyon in Utah. It's based on a true story. Critic David Edelstein reviews them both.
Due Date and 127 Hours will be huge hits, in part because they aim low and hit their targets, in part because, like the number one films of the past few weeks, Jackass 3D and Saw 3D, they're relentlessly in your face. Todd Phillips's Due Date has a premise so tired I'm bored even recounting it. Two mismatched men thrown together on a desperate road trip. But at every point, Phillips gets nastier and filthier. Another filmmaker would have the uptight straight arrow annoyed by, say, his slobby companions snoring. Here, Robert Downey Jr.'s Peter tries to sleep in the back seat of a car as, up front, Zach Galifianakis's Ethan, well, trust me, he's just gross. Like Phillips's other comedies, this one begins with its protagonist repulsed by a heavy man's sweat and other excretions and ends with him trumpeting his love. Bromance is in the air, la la. At least they're a classy pair of bromantics. Downey has perfect pitch. Like the funniest slow burners, he looks truly capable of murder. Galifianakis makes Ethan disarmingly matter-of-fact. The more chaos he engenders, the more exquisite his dignity. Sitting opposite Peter in a diner, while mysteriously clutching a coffee can, he can't fathom his traveling companion's hostility.
So, Peter, what brought you to Atlanta? Business or pleasure?
Business.
Business? What kind of business?
Architecture.
How'd you get into architecture?
College. Anything else? Because I'm trying to...
I'm sorry, Peter. We're going to be traveling for a few days, and it wouldn't hurt to get to know each other.
Ethan, what brought you to Atlanta? Business or pleasure?
My daddy died. I went to Atlanta to go to his funeral.
Gee, I didn't know. I'm sorry.
He's the one that kind of motivated me to get on the TV.
I have a friend. He's in that industry.
Does he work on 2.5 Men?
No.
Man, that's too bad, because 2.5 Men is the reason I wanted to become an actor.
Right.
Especially the second season.
Why do you even have this?
Oh, because this is my daddy. These are his ashes.
Why are your father's ashes in a coffee can, Ethan?
Because he's dead, Peter.
What happens to those ashes is genuinely riotous. But at Journey's End, Due Date is still a formula mismatched buddy comedy that goes nowhere you haven't been. For all its naughty boy touches, it's all too happy to hug the interstate. The come-on for 127 Hours is an even mightier gross-out. Based on a memoir called Between a Rock and a Hard Place, the film recounts how Aaron Ralston, played by James Franco, is pinned under a boulder in an isolated Utah canyon and forced, after nearly 5 days with no hope of rescue, to cut off his arm. I read the book and knew going in the movie would be rough, but not that director Danny Boyle would be such a tease. At one point, Aaron gazes on his arm, turning black and clearly doomed anyway, and you think, here we go. But no, not yet. And then later, here it comes. Nope. But the third time, that's the charm. Boyle is a panderer par excellence. I don't mean that to sound quite as unflattering as it does, because it's an art to know when to tease and when to deliver. But in his work, we're rarely left with much beyond the fading memory of sensations, jump cuts of a young man running from a drug dealer in Train Spotting, a low-angle view of a falling drop of zombie blood in 28 Days Later, a music video of young people dancing on a train platform in Slumdog Millionaire, 127 Hours has a music video syntax all the way through. Boyle opens with random people in motion, multiple split screens, and pictures in pictures, and Franco's Aaron is so energized he practically climbs the walls before he hits those Utah canyons, whereupon Boyle's camera swoops over the mighty cliffs. And once his protagonist is wedged, Boyle doesn't entirely settle down. The real Aaron had a video camera with him and taped goodbyes to his parents. And those bits in the movie are compelling. Franco stops mugging and talks to someone other than himself. But Boyle also strives to evoke Aaron's mental landscape, which means dreams and visions and flashbacks and lots of whooshing camera work and pop music. The only time he stays in one place is for, you guessed it, that arm severing. When it comes, it's a test of our endurance. I failed. I opted to watch in finger vision through a web of digits that opened and mostly closed. It's a long 4 minutes or so, and there's sound, too. 127 hours leaves you jittery, crazed. I hated every minute, but its combination of Jackass-style gross-outs and never-say-die American uplift looks to me like box office gold.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.